Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. We're doing something virtually undone on Bookworm. We're talking about movies today. The film scholar and historian Joseph McBride has written a book about Ernst Lubitsch called How Did Lubitsch Do It? It's published by Columbia University Press, and it is said that now you say the name Ernst Lubitsch, and it elicits a blank stare. But when I was a sophomore at the State University of New York at Buffalo, the film critic, he was the critic for Esquire magazine and a brilliant political writer as well, and a wit, Dwight MacDonald, came and taught a class in film comedy, and he showed the film Trouble in Paradise. As it happens, Trouble in Paradise is the first Lubitsch film that the film historian Joseph McBride, who wrote this book, How Did Lubitsch Do It? It's the first film he saw, too. And anyone who's lucky enough to fall under the spell of Lubitsch is transformed permanently. Here in Los Angeles, from where the show emanates, we're about to have a Lubitsch Festival. Write it down. It's going to be at the Hammer Museum. It's being sponsored by the UCLA Film and Television Archives. And for the next month and a half, you'll be able to see two Lubitsches, sometimes three a week. This is the first book that has ever taken both parts of Lubitsch's career into account. He was already in Germany, not just a film star, he played a schleppy Jew.
Yeah, a schlemiel character, a comedian, knockabout comedian. He started with low comedy and wound up doing high comedy.
And he rises inevitably the way we do, us Jews, to the top of the heap. And my special guest is, do you know who I have here? I have the daughter of Ernst Lubitsch, Nicola Lubitsch, with us too. When I spoke to her and asked her to come, she told me this might have been from one of her father's scripts. I would love to, but I'll be the decoration. I heard the woman who's facing me, Nicola, talk about Ernst Lubitsch and call him
Daddy.
Daddy. What wouldn't we give to be able to call Ernst Lubitsch Daddy?
Well, I was Daddy's girl.
You were Daddy's girl. Yeah. Unfortunately, he died when you were 9.
Right.
He was very young. I believe he was 55.
I think so.
Yeah. But you were the apple of his eye.
I was. Somebody once asked me what I could say about him, and really is that I felt loved beyond anything. And I think that's the greatest gift a parent can give to their child, right?
The greatest gift a writer and a director can give to the film is loving it outlandishly. And he goes through a whole cycle of development from his silent films to his American Hollywood sound films. You sense the love for every detail, every line, every joke. He was as well known as Hitchcock would later be. The Lubitsch touch became a cliche to the point that when Lubitsch started getting rougher in his films, less delicate, it was the Lubitsch sledgehammer. We go through all these films in this book, How Did Lubitsch Do It? I regard Gubitsch as a descendant in film of Dickens? If there is a tradition of the hilarious minor character, the character whose repetitions make him memorable, whether that's Wemmick in Great Expectations, Gubitsch does it too, and he does it with great originality, all the way through verve and freshness. First of all, describe Trouble in Paradise as it appeared to you when you saw it. You were an undergraduate student in Madison, Wisconsin.
University of Wisconsin was running a film society, and we showed Trouble in Paradise. And, you know, part of the reason he hasn't been as well known as he should be, I mean, he was a big name in his time. He was a household word like Hitchcock. His films became inaccessible for a long time, partly because of censorship, partly because times changed. But Trouble in Paradise reappeared in the late 60s, and I saw this film, and I was just bowled over, and I thought at the time, I've just seen this guy's masterpiece, which is a strange feeling because he made 72 films, and what did I know about the other ones? But now I've seen all, except one was just rediscovered, a part of a film called The Rosenthal Case. 19 minutes were just found, but I've seen everything else, 49 films, which is a pretty good survival rate, and it is still his best film, in my opinion. It's the epitome of romantic comedy. I think it's the best of the genre.
It's crazy. You're in an invented world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a name like the made-up names in his operettas. Mm-hmm. It's taking place, as he called it, in MGM Paris. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, these are people invented whole cloth, with their eccentricities and their beauties and their humors. It was Paul Gauguin who said about the people he painted that they were jewels wearing jewels. Mm. And in Trouble in Paradise, the characters are jewels wearing jewels.
And the film is a jewel. It's a jewel-like in its precision.
It's
about
precision.
Jewel thieves. And one of Lubitsch's colleagues said there was nothing realistic about his films. Everything was artificial. It was the world he created. And that's part of what is charming and delightful. It's his world that he invented. You know, the early filmmakers were inventing this new medium, too, and he was a silent filmmaker, and he learned how to use montage and gestures and looks and to tell stories without words. And he avoided titles as much as possible in his silent films. You understand, very sophisticated films, but as he said, a child could understand them.
Although he made films before those censors, the Hayes office, the Breen office, came into being, it was the Gubitsch film that necessitated censorship.
Yeah, right.
He practically created...
Yeah, Designed for Living, I believe, was the first film condemned by the Legion of Decency. It's about a menage a trois. It's a very outrageous film even today. How many films do you see in America about a menage a trois three people love each other very much is what Noel Coward called the play. And Lubitsch's film, I think, improves on the play. And it's very daring and very sophisticated, and the audience loved it. And then very soon the code was imposed in 1934, the real draconian code, and they started not releasing his films again.
Yes, but what Lubitsch did, even before the draconian codes came in, was to find a way to sidestep them. Mm-hmm. So although someone is very decorously closing the door of the bedroom behind which our actors, beautiful actors, will frolic, we know what's going on behind the bedroom door. Mm-hmm. Not only that, in one of the silent films, a father peers in through the keyhole to watch his daughter, and he's rather impressed.
On her wedding night.
On her
wedding
night.
And he turns to the camera and leers, and he says, "Now I'm impressed." And it fades out. It's really raunchy. His German films are pretty raunchy. He got more subtle when he came to America. The German films are delightful, but he was so subtle in Hollywood. As Jean Renoir said, he invented the modern Hollywood.
It's How Did Lubitsch Do It, which we're talking about. It's a title that comes from a sign that Billy Wilder, who took Gubitsch as a mentor and a friend.
Wilder had a sign on his wall that Saul Steinberg did for him,
The New Yorker artist.
Yeah, I said, how would Lubitsch do it? And he said he put it on the wall so that I would never write a sentence that would embarrass my good friend Ernst Lubitsch, who he had written the scripts of Bluebeard's Eighth Wife and Ninotchka with, and he was his mentor and god.
The first Lubitsch film I saw was Heaven Can Wait, which is very much based on my father's life or a lot of things about it. And he took me to the studio and ran it for me. And there's a scene in it where this kind of impossible woman goes to the devil to try and explain why she should go to heaven. And he looks at her and takes a look at her legs, which are really ugly. And as she's talking, a mile a minute, he opens the door, and she goes down to hell, and all this fire comes out. And I was just a little girl, and I started to scream and cry, and they had to carry me out of the screening room. And I never saw it again until I was grown up. Never. My grandfather was kind of a ladies' man, and he didn't seem to do any kind of work that anybody really ever saw him do. He went to cafes and would read the paper and sign things with a little seal. He never actually wrote. And then my grandmother died first, and after Daddy came, you know, when they lived together, then my grandfather would be coming home as Daddy was going to work in the morning. And then he always had sort of younger women around, and then he wanted to marry one. Mm. When Daddy was in America, and Daddy said, no, absolutely not. So I think that the man in that is based on my grandfather in great part.
Lubitsch treats women with great amounts of feeling, and he invents women with great amounts of feeling. I would say, especially in Trouble in Paradise, there are two rival women, each of which has so many points in her favor, such beauty, such devotion, such insightfulness, that you wouldn't be able to choose either, and that's part of what you see when you see the film. Now, as I was reading Joseph McBride's book, How Did Lubitsch Do It?, I learned that the family specialty, they made coats, but not just coats, clothes. Coats for large women.
They did a collection, you know, like you would do it, and every season there was a collection, and my cousin, who was 20 years older than I was, because we're all off, because my father was so much younger. Anyway, she told me Dutch women were their number one clients because all the clothes were for large women. And Dutch women, forgive me if you're Dutch and slender, but Dutch women are large, or many of them.
Truffaut once said you can always tell somebody's previous occupation in a director, you know, what they've done before. And Lubitsch started as a clerk in his father's tailor shop, and he was not a good clerk. He was a klutz, and he didn't like that kind of work. But, I mean, he was around clothing, and so the clothing in his films, especially the women's gowns, are gorgeous, and the texture, it's very sensual, and the whole look of his films is sensual, the Art Deco sets and the lovely furnishings, the fantasy aspect of his films, it's a world you want to live in, and the poignancy is partly that you know that he would have been excluded from that world, perhaps, by being Jewish, especially those mythical kingdoms that he dealt with, he would have been an outsider. And he Samson Raphaelson, who is his screenwriter, said
and,
that...
And was related to the Raphaelson who directed Five Easy Pieces.
Was he?
Yeah, yes.
That's right, Bob Raphaelson. Yeah,
yes.
That's right. Yes, oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said that, you know, Lubitsch and I never met a king. He said, we laughed our heads off at kings. That's an interesting comment because Lubitsch grew up in the Wilhelmine Empire, and he was, you know, he was an outsider in that world. Most of his American films are set in Europe as well. And one of the great things he did for American film, and probably the greatest, is bring a continental sensibility to our puritanical world, which we're even more puritanical now than we were back then. But he brought a tolerance of adultery and threesomes and all kinds of unorthodox sexual relationships to his work. As you say, in Trouble in Paradise, that's one of the things I've always loved so much, is that the two women Kay Francis and Miriam Hopkins are both so wonderful that you really...
And they're so different.
You couldn't choose from them. Yeah, they're really different. And also, Kay Francis, at first you think, well, she's this rich factory owner. She must be not a nice person. But she turns out to be a very good, warm-hearted person.
Gracious. And tender.
Yeah.
And the way she holds her hand when she's handing a necklace.
Mm.
She is Madame Collet.
Yeah.
She's the head of a...
perfume.
Women's perfume company, but her board of directors is horrible. She can afford a jewel thief or two.
Yeah, and she controls these guys in a very clever way by using her wiles as playing the kind of dumb widow, rich widow. But she really wraps them around her finger. But my favorite moment in Lubitsch is when the man in the film, Herbert Marshall, has to leave. Because society dictates, that's one of the things that happens in Lubitsch films, is that no matter how much you might want to have unorthodox relationships, society has certain rules that you have to follow. And he has to leave because otherwise he'll go to jail and she'll have a scandal. And so he has to leave Kay Francis behind. And she gives jewels to Miriam Hopkins. I mean, she steals them.
A rifle.
She says, with the compliments of Collet and company, it's so gracious.
You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking to Joseph McBride about his critical biography about Ernst Lubitsch. How did Lubitsch do it? We have some decoration here. She has called herself decoration. It is the beloved Nicola Lubitsch, Lubitsch's daughter. She worked at KCRW for many years. It's
many
a pleasure
years.
To have you here.
Thank you, Michael. It's so weird to be back here. I must say, I've spent so many hours in this studio in another life.
We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking with Joseph McBride about his critical biography of Ernst Lubitsch, How Did Lubitsch Do It? It's an analysis of the directorial style, but really you get to travel into what happens to movies as Lubitsch comes to America, invents his personal style here, grows older, and America changes. Along comes Frank Capra with his first hit, It Happened One Night, which is about regular Joes, ordinary guys. Well, Lubitsch says, I see. No more Madame Collet of Collet and Company. Mm. Let's have the shop around the corner.
Mm.
And there he gives Jimmy Stewart the first time we're really seeing the Jimmy Stewart of awkwardness and heart and hurt feelings and splendid depth of recognition. Also in it is the marvelous Margaret Sullavan. The Shop Around the Corner is my second favorite Lubitsch, and it became the Broadway musical She Loves Me, which has never stopped being revived. And if you see The Shop Around the Corner, you will see what it means to have depth of feeling for all of your co-workers. They are all inventing such politesse. These are working guys who are showing us that even if you're a clerk, you can have immaculate manners and understanding of others. Now, as I understand it, your father was kind of raucous.
Not to me, he wasn't. I have to say, I never saw that side of him.
You never saw
it? Nope. I read about it. But I don't. He was a man. He never raised his voice. He never used bad language. It was really quite extraordinary, and manners were absolutely the most important thing to him.
And were you taught manners?
Oh, absolutely.
How were you taught them?
Once I got really upset because they put me on a diet, and I came into the dining room and there was no butter on my plate, and I went and went into the kitchen and made this big fuss about it, and then I was told that Mommy and Daddy had said that I wasn't to have any, so I took my plate in the dining room and I just threw it across the dining room, and Daddy just got up from the table and left and walked out and turned to Otto and said, "I will eat in the study."
Mm. So there we are. We've gone from the aristocracy of filmmaking to the shop around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
He even takes Jack Benny, turns him into a famous Polish actor, Joseph Tura. Is that his name? Carol Lombard is his wife, equally hammy, Maria Tura. They're in a play called To Be or Not to Be, but the performances are interrupted by the Nazis. And this is the shocking Lubitsch. He does a comedy. What year is it?
1942. It was made in 41, before the U.S. entered the war, and actually at the time Pearl Harbor happened, they were making the film. So it came out in early 42 when the world was in a very, very bad state. Lubitsch made the point when some critics attacked it as being in bad taste. He said the audience liked it. He said, you know, that's what I care about, is the people understood it, it did well. But some critics were outraged. They didn't understand black comedy in those days. That's something we all began to understand with Dr. Strangelove and later films. But this was a very unusual, very daring subject and treatment of Nazism. And he wrote an eloquent piece in the New York Times defending the film, and he said, for example, my Nazis don't whip people in the film. They don't beat people. He said they've passed that long before. What they do is they make jokes about it. You know, they're so callous.
Okay, I'm going to say it. We all have to remember how to laugh, even at times like these.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to laugh, and Lubitsch taught us how.
Mm-hmm.
There hadn't been a film comedy like To Be or Not to Be mm-hmm. before To Be or Not to Be. It's astounding. Jack Benny says, what is the line? I hear they call you concentration camp.
Earhart, yeah. That line caused some uproar. But I was thinking about it recently when one of the head of Homeland Security was talking about our detention camps, and she said, well, they're like summer camps. That made me think of what Jack Benny says in character as a Nazi. He says, oh, yes, we do the concentrating and the Poles do the camping.
We need, in order to stand up to, we need to be able to diminish them with our laughter.
Mm-hmm.
We need to. Otherwise, we're lost.
Yeah.
We need to diminish them with our laughter. We need to diminish them with our good manners.
Yeah.
We need to diminish them with the suavity of our jokes.
Yeah, and Greenberg, the Jewish character in the troupe, actually, Jack Benny was Jewish, and a lot of people knew that, but he didn't make a big thing of it. But Greenberg is portrayed by Felix Pressart, who's a wonderful character actor who's in Ninotchka and other Lubitsch films, and he was kind of like an alter ego for Lubitsch, but he's the one who gets to give Shylock's great speech, "Hath not a Jew eyes," et cetera, and he does that to a character.
If you prick us, do we not bleed?
Right. He says it to Hitler, which is, it's complicated, but there's a character of Hitler, and he's risking his life, literally, and he disappears from the film at that point, and there's a terrific essay by a scholar who points out that Greenberg is not there at the end of the film when they all escape to England.
He's been disappeared.
He's been disappeared.
All the bedroom scenes he doesn't show become the torture scenes he doesn't show in To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah, the Lubitsch.
It's the Lubitsch touch used for discretion even among the barbarous.
Yeah, they do it off camera, and that's a kind of a good insight into totalitarian things. They like to do things out of public sight so you don't have to take responsibility for them. But there's a great suicide scene in there where one of the Nazis tries to kill himself behind a closed door. Lubitsch was known for his door shots of all kinds. So even suicide is funny, but it's off camera, you know. And that's part of the essence of Lubitsch's humor. He flatters your intelligence. That's what Wilder said. he allows you to add things up in your head. He doesn't spell it out like most directors do.
Please, all of you out there, understand that to be or not to be, The Shop Around the Corner, Trouble in Paradise, we're talking about masterpieces. As great a masterpiece as has ever been put on film, most people are incapable of even one masterpiece. Lubitsch had masterpieces after masterpieces. We didn't even mention Ninotchka. I'm talking to the author of How Did Lubitsch Do It? Its publication is simultaneous with an ongoing Lubitsch Festival being sponsored by UCLA TV and Film Archive. It's at the Hammer Museum. Go online, look it up, see some Lubitsch films. Wasn't this fun?
Yeah, it was so much fun to talk about him and just remember moments we love. And I do love, too, when Nicola first called him Daddy, I got a thrill. I thought, it's so wonderful that you can be here to represent him and tell us what he was really like in person. And I wish I had known him. Peter Bogdanovich once wrote an article called The Film Director I Never Met. He unfortunately died in 1947, the year I was born, and so we never got to meet him.
Yes, Joe, but we can imagine him.
Yeah.
We have this body of films that allow us to imagine an almost unimaginably sensitive, funny, delicate, fragile inventor of the art of film. What a pleasure.
Who loved women. That was the essence. Mm. He loved music and he loved women. And I think in this time of Me Too and all of that, really, his films are incredibly relevant.
And his respectfulness for women. The Me Too women would not have something to complain about when talking about Ernst Lubitsch, the subject of the show. I've been talking with Joseph McBride, author of How Did Lubitsch Do It?, published by Columbia University Press. I have also with us Nicola Lubitsch, the daughter of Lubitsch. It's a great pleasure and honor to have both of you. I have to tell you, I want to do this again and again. I don't want you to go away. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Ellen Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan, who has been introducing me to Precode Hollywood Films. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when David Sedaris is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.